All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Jim Fossone.
And welcome to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone with VeteransRadio.net.
I am your officer of the deck today, Lieutenant J.G. Type. We have two great programs for you today that I think you'll truly enjoy. I know I did in talking to these individuals. Before we get started on the interviews, though, we want to mention our sponsors, Legal Help for Veterans, a veterans disability law firm handling claims all around the nation. You can reach them at 800-693-4800 or legalhelpforveterans.com. Our VSO sponsors include Vietnam Veterans of America, Charles S. Kettles Chapter, 310 in Ann Arbor, Michigan, American Legion Post 46 out of Ann Arbor, the VFW Graft O'Hara Post 423, and U.S. Wings, which provides those great giveaway leather bomber jackets. They've been online for decades now, and you can find them at uswings.com. We also want to encourage you to go to our website, veteransradio.net, and help us out with a few sponsorships, maybe some buddy money, maybe being involved in buying some of our new swag at the veteransradio.net swag store, or PX or exchange. That also helps promote and keep this program on the air. And now to our interviews. First up will be an interview with Kyle Carpenter. He's a Marine Lance Corporal who in 2010, in his words, cuddled a grenade on a rooftop in Helmand Province, Afghanistan, saving his fellow Marines. The book really talks about his remarkable recovery, the surgeries, view on life, which is it's worth living, and his view that his service is because, quote, you are worth it. And second, we'll talk to the president and CEO of the Marine Toys for Tot Foundation, retired Marine Corps Lieutenant General Pete Osman. He'll be talking about the importance of Toys for Tots, and hopefully it will inspire you to get out and give our Marines some toys as they collect them this Christmas season for those who are less fortunate. Settle back, enjoy yourself, and listen in. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Kyle Carpenter, a Marine who, as a result of his actions in November of 2010, ultimately became the recipient of the Medal of Honor. Kyle, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Thank you so much, sir. I appreciate you having me, and it's always an honor and a privilege to address veterans and those who support veterans, so thank you again.
Well, Lance Corporal, we want to talk a little bit about your upbringing before we get to your action in Afghanistan, because you're a good old Southern boy. Tell us where you grew up and how you grew up.
So I was born in Mississippi and spent a few years there. But my dad is in business and sales, and as that goes, kind of working up the ladder and into different positions, I spent some time in Alabama, Georgia, Tennessee, but my family and I ended up in South Carolina going on 13 years ago now, which we call home, and we have a really great community here and love it. But yes, my roots are kind of everywhere, but I have a soft spot for Mississippi as well.
Well, I want to frame this a little bit because I think your upbringing for those first 20 years or so before you joined the Marine Corps really is the foundation in which you got yourself through that eventful day, but more importantly, through the surgeries and things that followed. You had the typical, young kid in the South upbringing. You played football. it was a passion, team sports. You had a couple of twin brothers who were sort of looking up to you. You grew up thinking you were Superman when you were a little kid. I mean, give us a little bit of that flavor.
Yeah, so you're right. I mean, you could say typical. And with that said, you know, I very much understand that many people and many of my fellow veterans and just everyone does not get, you know, two loving, amazing parents and don't have that tremendous upbringing. So I am very thankful for that. And like you already touched on, I very much believe and know that that foundation, you know, gave me the tools that I was able to build on and employ, you know, through later parts of my life. You know, my parents are amazing. They have been there since the moment I was born, and they've been there since the moment that, in a way, I was kind of reborn when I woke up 5 weeks after getting injured. You know, they were there the moment I woke up in the hospital, and they haven't left my side since. But, you know, growing up and just being taught, you know, simple yet profound lessons, you know, take responsibility for your actions. You know, I saw my mom day in and day out, address books and cards and anything you can send to people all over our house. And, you know, whether it was something small or something big, you know, my mom would write thank you notes herself to everyone. If we got anything, any sort of gift, any holidays, myself and my brothers would be sitting down at the kitchen table and writing thank you notes as well, just to say thank you and show people appreciation. And just little things like that, that I've always carried with me. And from thanking, you know, the janitor at school, to my teachers, to the administration, to, you know, all the people that had a small part in helping me grow and learn and make it through life.
Well, I think it's important that everybody kind of reflect on their own upbringing and see maybe how they're raising their own kids or their nieces or nephews, because it is that foundational development that's going to get you through the other things that come along in life. And we're talking to Kyle Carpenter, who with co-author Don Yeager has written a book that's coming out now, You Are Worth It, Building a Life Worth Fighting For. It's the story of Kyle's life and leading up to and through his being the recipient of the Medal of Honor. This is a William Morrow imprint book, Harper and Collins Publishers, so we want to make sure we point that out. And Kyle, one thing that was kind of typical, you were the kid who got out of high school and said, college or military service? And you elected to go off to the Marines in about, was it 2009?
That is correct. Yes, sir. March of 2009, I went to boot camp at Parris Island.
What prompted you to head towards the military service?
I wanted to do something bigger than myself, and regret and unfilled potential is, I would say, but besides hand grenades now, my only two fears in life. And I just wanted to do something that was bigger than any one individual. And I wanted to do it and not have the fear of waking up one day when I had missed my opportunity and have regret about not joining and not committing myself and now my body and my life to, you know, something greater than myself or any one person or individual.
Well, the book goes through all the training that you and the unit does to get through boot camp and trained up, and ultimately you find yourself in Afghanistan. And since you brought up grenades, we'll move to November 21st of 2010. Tell us about that fateful day.
So roughly a day and a half to 2 days before, on November 19th, myself and the rest of my squad moved to a village and a location south of the small patrol base that we had been living and operating out of for the first 4 months so far of our deployment. Looking ahead, we were over the halfway point. And for anyone not completely familiar for how things work in combat zones or when other units are coming to relieve you, you know, before those next units come in and you go home, what you want to do is expand your presence from how you found it and took it over from the unit that you relieve. So, you know, we went into Marja. We relieved 3-6, another Marine Corps Infantry unit. And nearing that next rip, we call it, we wanted to push out and expand our presence. And that helps not only continue to push the enemy further out, but also with pushing the enemy further out, making things safer and more comfortable for the locals. Then once, you know, the threats are gone, people start coming out more, you know, they want to take advantage and hopefully one day be able to send their children to school and have, you know, paved roads and running water. So just pushing out that presence more to create more and more stability. And so we had pushed down to a village south of our position and, you know, within the hour, very soon after we took over that compound, the first grenade attack came. And for the next 24 to 36 hours, we were attacked constantly by AK-47s, small arm fire, snipers, and multiple attacks with hand grenades. And, you know, when all was kind of said and done and it was time a few days later for my squad after myself and many of my fellow Marines were injured, to go back to the base where we had initially started out at, we were almost at 50% casualties and we had barely, left our four walls of safety of the base that we were currently occupying. But, the day I was injured, November 21st, 2010, myself and a fellow Marine, one of the most amazing and greatest Marines that I have ever had the pleasure of serving with and someone I'm thankful to call a best friend, Nick Euphrasio. We were on top of a roof together on post. And post is essentially, for those not familiar with military terminology, it's a lookout position. And we were on this roof looking out for any, you know, more hand grenade attacks, any attacks that might injure the Marines who aren't vigilant and on watch and either cleaning their weapons, eating, resting inside the compound. We were at the end of our 4 hour shift, which was the afternoon of November 21st. And, unfortunately, I don't remember anything in the moments leading up to that daylight grenade attack. The only thing I remember from the entire day before, is that morning, rolling out of my sleeping bag around 7:45 or 8 a.m., we were getting attacked. It was a daybreak attack with AK-47s. And it was, you know, that had kind of become our alarm clock over there. So I remember unzipping my sleeping bag and rolling out and kind of thinking, well, you know, here we go, another day in Afghanistan. Fast forward to that afternoon, and really the only thing I remember from the day and the attack is after the grenade exploded, I remember physically how I felt. At first, I was extremely disoriented, and I was reeling from the blast. I just felt like I got really hit hard in the face, and I was trying to put the pieces together. I was thinking, you know, okay, I was in Afghanistan. The last thing I remember, I was on a roof, but what could have possibly injured me this bad on a roof? Maybe I got off and went on patrol. and I stepped on IED, and maybe this is just the last thing I can remember. And those thoughts and me trying to put those pieces together was interrupted by the feeling of what I was thinking in the moment at the time to be warm water. And it just shows you how much Marines love each other and how much we pick on each other, because I was thinking, man, in this banged up, like, terrible shape and state that I'm in, my buddies are still messing with me. But, you know, the pieces unfortunately and quickly fell into place and gave me this surreal realization that what I was feeling was not warm water, and it was blood, and I was bleeding out very quickly.
So let me set this, Kyle, because you've acknowledged that, you know, when it happened, you don't have a lot of memory of it, but it's in the book. Yes, it's been pieced together by your comrades and the other Lance Corporal who was up on the roof on post with you. So there was a grenade thrown up on the roof, and instinctually, yes, you covered the grenade to protect your buddy, and your body took the brunt of this grenade explosion, which blew through a lot of you and through the roof. And then there was this amazing effort by your squad and the medics and everybody else to save your life, because, as you say, you're feeling all this quote-unquote water. What it really is you're bleeding out, but they're able to apply tourniquets and save you in the moment and get you on to greater medical care. Do you remember the flights to the various steps along the way to get ultimately to the medical hospital?
No, sir, I do not. And you're absolutely right. I mean, the incredible Navy corpsmen and my fellow Marines that were with me. You know, I still don't know what to say to people that saved your life 9 years later now. But I am forever grateful and indebted to them. But no, sir, to answer your question, you know, once I realized that I was bleeding out, I thought about my family very quickly, how devastated they were going to be that I did not make it home. And I said a quick prayer for forgiveness and for anything that I had done wrong in my life. And once I went unconscious in that moment, I did not wake up again for almost 5 weeks. And I did. When I did wake up, it was at Walter Reed National Military Medical Center, right outside of Washington, D.C. in Bethesda, Maryland.
And veteran radio listeners, we're talking to Marine Kyle Carpenter, who was a Lance Corporal in Afghanistan. His phrase is, he cuddled a grenade, which I thought was a great turn of phrase.
And which I don't recommend.
Which he does not recommend. And the book, You Are Worth It, which is a great saying, I hope we have time to talk about it a little bit, really walks us through from piecing the story together of the miraculous saving of his life right after this incident where he cuddles the grenade. And you've got to pick it up and read it, because it's going to not only make you feel that, man, this Carpenter guy is, you know, he is Superman, but you're going to see that the medics and the other Marines who jump into action here, boy, it's really inspiring and great to know that these great Americans are out there. But in your instance, it you know, you're in a coma, you don't wake up. It's weeks and weeks and weeks before you even get to some sort of semblance of a prognosis of being able to move forward. And I think I read somewhere you had like 24 different surgeries.
That might be around where we lost, me and Mom lost count, but I think I got up to, 40 or so. You know, many of those, they would put me to sleep and do multiple life-saving operations and limb-saving surgeries during that time. But overall, you know, it took about 40 surgeries in 3 years to put Humpty Dumpty back together again.
Well, they've done a great job with you, and I want to talk a little bit about the support network that allowed this for you to get through this, the amount of pain, emotional, physical, hallucinations through this recovery process, again, detailed in the book, making it definitely worth reading. But what I don't want to concentrate on that. I want to concentrate on Mom, Dad, and Sadie. Talk to us. Talk to us about those three.
Wow, where to start? Just, you know, to wake up in the physical state that I was in, and to mentally have left off on a hot, dusty rooftop in Afghanistan, and now there is inches of snow building outside of my window pane in a military hospital over 7,000 miles away. You know, I was in bad shape any way you cut it, and I was very disoriented. I wasn't, you know, as a young Lance Corporal, first combat deployment, I wasn't versed or an expert in any way as to military medicine. So to see doctors who I've always seen in white lab coats, you know, wearing camouflage now, it was just so bizarre, and I was so disoriented. The only thing that wasn't injured on me was my left ankle. And, you know, from the second I woke up, the first thing I saw was Christmas stockings. My mom had decorated my room for the holidays. My family was there, my two brothers. And just, you know, from that moment on, just to have, whether it's beside your hospital bed or beside you in life, or beside you while you're receiving the Medal of Honor in the White House, you know, at the foundational level, just to have someone beside you that says, hey, I support you and I love you and I'm here for you. No, you know, veteran or not, military or not, injured or not, just as a person and as a human being, to have people and my family, yes, the amazing staff at Walter Reed, you know, just from the moment I woke up, to have the love and support I did, it was, you know, hard for me almost to not stay positive. You know, I woke up and I was alive. You know, incredible, amazing step number one. I just could not believe it, because I truly thought, when I felt myself bleeding out, that that was it. And then I wake up to this bonus round. Yes, I've been fighting for my life. It was so hard and terrible to breathe through a tube for months. And it took me a long, hard road to recovery to get back on my feet. But at the foundation of it all, to just be loved and supported and have a helping hand around my shoulder, you know, was enough to help me be able to continue to knock out the baby steps and, you know, strive to reach that full potential in whatever step of recovery I was in.
Now, Kyle, you've got to talk about Sadie. I gave it a teaser here. You got to bring her back in.
Sadie is our ferocious guard dog, white and fluffy, and about 9.5 pounds. But
now you got to say, no, I want my veteran radio listeners to picture this. Here's this badass Lance Corporal Marine. The guy jumps on a grenade, and one of the things that really helps you get through some down times is this fluffy white dog, Sadie.
Well, thankfully, I know there's a lot of dog lovers out there, so I don't feel like I'm being judged. But, you know, Sadie, she was like any just great dog. She, because after I spent my initial kind of life-saving inpatient 3 months at Walter Reed, you know, at the time, the casualty rate coming in was astronomical. So at one point, there were hospital beds in the hallways at Walter Reed. So when it came time for me to, you know, still need to be taken care of medically, but also I didn't have to stay inpatient every second of every day, I was allowed by the military and the staff at Walter Reed to go home and recover until that following September. And I got done with Walter Reed at the end of January, but I got to go home for about 7 months and recover. And all I could do was lay on the couch and, you know, I had the tough job of eating mom's amazing homemade Southern cooked food all the time. But, you know, I just laid on the couch and she likes her personal space and, doesn't love to be bothered all the time if she's in nap mode. But, you know, I think she knew and she sat there with me every second of every day for those 7 months and, helped me get better and, you know, she's the best.
Well, those of us who are dog lovers, and I think that's most of the United States, really understand the therapeutic value of and the that you get from having your own dog right there with you. We'll stop the interview here so that we can get to our news break. We'll have a lot more with Medal of Honor recipient Marine Lance Corporal Kyle Carpenter. This is one of my best and favorite interviews of the year, so you'll want to come back and hear some more about how he got notified of the award and sort of how it's affected his life since. We'll also have a chance to hear from the CEO and president of the Marines Toys for Tots Foundation. So after the news, come on back to WHAM and listen in to these great interviews. And don't forget to go to veteransradio.net. You can help us out by providing some buddy money to sponsorships to keep us going and to visit our exchange, our new PX store, and buy some swag, which also supports the cause.
The Medal of Honor is the highest award for valor in combat given a member of the Armed Forces of the United States. There have been over 3,400 recipients of the nation's highest award. This is one of them.
Sergeant First Class Paul Smith gave his life to protect his troops. Details after this.
On April 4th, 2003, a call went out for a place to put some Iraqi prisoners. Sergeant First Class Paul Smith volunteered to create a holding pen inside a walled courtyard. Soon, Iraqi soldiers, numbering perhaps 100, opened fire on Smith's position. Smith was accompanied by 16 men. Smith called for a Bradley, a tank-like vehicle with a rapid-fire cannon. It arrived and opened up on the Iraqis. The enemy could not advance so long as the Bradley was in position, but then, in a move that baffled and angered Smith's men, the Bradley left. Smith's men, some of whom were wounded, were suddenly vulnerable. Smith could have justifiably ordered his men to withdraw. Smith rejected that option, thinking that abandoning the courtyard would jeopardize about 100 GIs outside, including medics at an aid station. He manned a 50 caliber machine gun atop an abandoned armored personnel carrier and fought off the Iraqis, going through several boxes of ammunition. As the battle wound down, Smith was hit in the head. He died before he could be evacuated from the scene.
The Medal of Honor series is a production of Veterans Radio.
All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
Welcome back to Veterans Radio. I am Jim Fossone, your officer of the deck today. And we're going to continue with my interview with Kyle Carpenter, a Medal of Honor recipient, a Marine who cuddled a grenade to protect some of his buddies, with a short but quick interview with the president of the Marines Toys for Tots Foundation. But I want to talk about two other things as we continue to move along here. You went through all of those things that we would expect somebody who lost an eye and had their arm, you know, messed up and their legs messed up. You really felt at one point like, hey, I'm damaged goods. Who's going to love me? How did you face that and work through that?
Yeah, you know, that's a great question, and I'm glad you brought that up, because really that's, out of everything I talk about in the book, this one extremely low moment was not only a defining moment in my recovery, but my life. And it was very shortly after I had left the hospital into February. So this was spring 2011. And, you know, I think up until that point, through all of the pain, the time at Walter Reed, just the surgeries, I think that, you know, I was strong and I was as good as I was and I pushed as hard as I did because, you know, aside from all of my physical stuff and my injuries, it was equally as much, if not more, an emotional and mental burden on me, knowing that my family and my parents who, you know, birthed me and loved me and, you know, I knew as a parent, I couldn't even imagine, but I knew how just heart-wrenching it had to be for them. So I tried not to show anything but positivity. You know, my dad says he'd never believe me, but I always would say I wasn't in pain because I didn't want to hurt them anymore. But I was at home in the spring of 11, and it was about 10 o'clock at night. It was almost very movie-like setting. The lights were kind of dim. You know, mom was the only one still up, and I was in the kitchen by myself. And I hadn't had any of my nerve surgeries on my arms. You know, I could barely operate enough or well enough to make a bowl of cereal. I mean, a huge task, one that I couldn't have even done a month before that. So I finally get this bowl of cereal made and I try to start eating it. You know, I can barely hold the spoon. Even that's a challenge. Up until a couple weeks before this point, my mom was still brushing my teeth, putting on my underwear, tying my shoes. And I'm sitting here trying to eat this bowl of cereal and the grenade, my doctors, I can't even express how amazing they rebuilt and put my face and my jaw back together. But the grenade blew most of my teeth out on the bottom and some on the top and really just completely destroyed my entire lower jaw and part of my upper jaw, pretty much everything from my eye sockets down. And so I'm sitting here trying to eat this bowl of cereal with no teeth and, you know, milk. I can't feel my chin because my nerves are severed. And I notice milk is all over my face, dribbling off my chin. And something inside me completely broke. And I started crying harder and harder until I was borderline point of hysterically crying. And mom rushes in and, you know, her first thought is, of course, you know, I'm in pain. What's wrong? And I just looked at her and I just said, you know, who's ever going to love me again? And yes, it was a low moment and it was so hard. And at the time I regretted saying it because I could see that it absolutely tore her in two. But, and you know, my book is essentially lessons that over time and reflection and personal growth, you know, I realized a life lesson that I wanted to convey to people. And now looking back, I'm so thankful for that moment, that low, terrible moment at the kitchen counter, because I realized, as upset and down and out as I was, that I could either get up, take one small step, and put one foot in front of the other and continue to push through not only my recovery, but the rest of my life and make the best with the cards that I've been dealt. Or the only other option that I had and that we have in life is when you get knocked down, you know, I could have sat at that kitchen counter for the rest of my life. I mean, that was my only, now I realize, you know, that, and I'm thankful I made the choice I did. And I didn't really know exactly what I was doing at the time. All I knew was that, you know, I could have got up and made the best of it and pushed forward, or I would have stayed right there, down and out, crying, you know.
Yeah, you know, I think.
And eating, trying to eat that bowl of cereal for the rest of my life. And so, really the turning point in my recovery and really where I've decided that I was always going to move forward and never look back and what happened is right there sitting at that kitchen counter.
And it's really those sorts of life lessons that we try to bring here on Veterans Radio to our listeners who might be having their own struggles. And we're talking to Kyle Carpenter, who's a Medal of Honor recipient, a Marine Lance Corporal, who cuddled a grenade and lived to tell about it, which is amazing. That's why he refers to his life now as part of the bonus round. And his book, You Are Worth It, Building a Life Worth Fighting For, is so extraordinary. Kyle, I want to talk to you about some of the other life lessons you've learned that maybe you can pass along. You're 30 years old, but you've lived through a lot at this point. You say don't hide the scars. Can you talk to us a little bit about that?
So, don't hide your scars, chapter in the book. You know, at one point in my recovery, I tried scar revision therapy. And, you know, the doctors, after I got out of surgery, they kind of said, hey, you know, we have this laser treatment. We can smooth a lot of these scars out on your face. And, you know, I was there for 3 years. It was there available. So I just kind of said, you know, why not? I'll try it. And I came out of that and my face was swollen. I mean, it literally looked like I had just stuck my head in a beehive. And so I got back to my room and I was looking at myself in the mirror and I kind of had a, like, what am I doing type moment. And I asked myself that for two reasons. One, trying to smooth out the scars on my face, would that be possible? Yeah, with a certain number of treatments, probably might make me look a little prettier. It'd be hard, but it might make me look a little prettier. But, you know, then you go, you know, down and you get to a massive scar on my neck. That goes from my ear all the way to the other side of my neck, my trach scar. And then we don't have enough time the rest of the day to talk about the scars from neck down. But, you know, it's kind of how I refer to it in the book. It would be, you know, smoothing the scars out on my face. It would be trying to buffer out a dent in a car that's been totaled. And so, you know, kind of evolving from that thought process. You know, I speak when I go and publicly or motivationally speak to people, you know, and I wrote this book and I tell people to own their scars. You know, who am I if I'm sitting here trying to get scar revision therapy and trying to get rid of the things that I'm telling people to be proud of and to own? And through that thought process, you know, I kind of solidified in my thought process that scars are, you know, really beautiful. And, you know, people might see them as physically different or physically, you know, ugly, but scars show, you know, are a physical representation that you have not only lived, but you've been knocked down or you've been, you know, injured or you've bled or you've had these hard times. And scars can be absolutely just as much mental and emotional as physical. Now, those are much tougher, obviously, because people can't see those a lot of the times and people might not want to talk about them. But as far as my physical scars and people's physical scars, you know, be proud of those. They show that you've lived a life and you've pushed through whatever gave you those scars. And now, yeah, you might have a scar, but you have knowledge and experience and more resilience and perseverance when the next challenge or, you know, the next life obstacle comes your way. And above that, you know, not only for yourself, but you can connect with other people who have struggled and, you know, struggle was kind of my light bulb term and moment, you know, when I realized I could write this book and focus it on struggle, because I didn't want to write another book about just strictly a military or combat focus. I wanted something that transcended all boundaries and that, you know, anyone could pick up and not only understand and process, but also take lessons from. And when I realized that the angle I could take is struggle, because everyone and every person on this planet, you know, that's that common thread through us all, mental, physical, or emotional.
Yep, absolutely.
Scars, own them and be thankful for them, because you're still living and you're still breathing and you're better and stronger, you know, than you were before.
That's what I think one of the real values of this book is, You Are Worth It by Kyle Carpenter. And I said to Kyle early on, before we got on air, that I read this book and immediately wanted to talk to him. But they said, no, the book's not coming out yet until October of 2019. You can't talk to him yet. And it's because it transcends. This isn't just a typical military war story book or even a recovery from a brutal medical condition. It's really got a lot of life lessons in it that apply to anybody in their circumstances if they read it and have an open mind in that regard. So I think you've accomplished your mission, Kyle, in writing about the struggle and making it available to others who may have different types of struggles. But we all have struggles and we all have scars. Some are more prominent, some of them are earned while saving somebody else's life, but we've all got to work through our struggles, don't we?
Absolutely, absolutely. And just like that moment at the kitchen counter, you know, it's okay to not have a plan or not know what the next step is or where you're going, but you need to realize, and if you need to take time to heal, whether it's a month or a year, that's okay. And that's completely fine, and you're on your own time for your own healing purposes. But one day, you know, as tough as a pill as it is to swallow, you're going to have to realize your only two options are to stay exactly where you are or take that one small baby step and put one foot in front of the other. And, you know, I think my favorite line from the book is, even the smallest of steps eventually completes the grandest of journeys. And that's something that, you know, was a hard lesson I had to learn over many years and many dark nights in the hospital, you know, but it is true. So you don't have to have a plan. You just have to just make that step.
Let me turn now, if we can, as we come to the close, and talk a little bit about the absolutely unique honor of being a Medal of Honor recipient. No one ever seeks to be a Medal of Honor recipient. Nobody ever expects to be such. And I don't think most people can understand the level of scrutiny that goes into receiving this highest honor that the military awards, the President awards. Tell us a little bit about the lead up to it, the ceremony, and then I've got some questions for you after that.
So, early on, when I was still during my three initial months of inpatient care, a fellow Marine had called me and kind of unofficially given me a heads up, you know, hey, we all saw what you did. The evidence is there. You know, essentially, we believe, at least just my platoon and my fellow Marines on the ground, that, you know, they believe that I deserved it. Well, you know, that's obviously just, even in a healthy, not injured state, that is a very difficult and big idea to even comprehend. So probably my brain, as a defense mechanism, I kind of forgot about it. I told him, thank you. I appreciate it. I was very honored that my fellow Marines and buddies thought that much of me. But, you know, we hung up and that was really it. And I focused on my recovery and I pushed forward. I didn't think another thing about it. And with anyone familiar with military awards process, I was years into my recovery, still at Walter Reed, and a Marine called me and told me essentially that they were officially gearing up and moving forward with a potential Medal of Honor investigation, and they wanted to talk to me about what I remembered and my actions that day on the roof. I apologized and told them, unfortunately, I couldn't contribute because I did not remember. And they thanked me. You know, talks really started to become official. And then after 6 months of, you know, kind of preparation and PR training and all of these things, I finally got word that of the day and the exact minute that President Obama would call me. So I left class and the call came through, and it was very, very surreal to talking to the President of the United States on the phone and him asking me about life and how things were going. And then he proceeded to tell me that based upon the recommendation from the Secretary of the Navy and the Secretary of Defense, he has approved for me to be awarded the Medal of Honor. He said he would see me in D.C., and I wrapped up the call and went back to class.
But as we wrap up, maybe my final question to you, because I think we could talk all afternoon, but let me ask you the final question here, which I've asked other Medal of Honor recipients. Talk to us about the responsibility you feel as a Medal of Honor recipient.
Well, probably, you know, the best note to end on. So I appreciate you leaving a little time for this. It is a beautiful burden. You know, first and foremost, I'll say that I'm so honored and humbled and appreciative that my country, my government, you know, our military and Marine Corps recognize me and my story. You know, therefore recognizing my unit, my fellow Marines, and what we went through as a band of brothers. You know, but to go deeper, and I'm so glad I can relay this because, you know, with the Medal of Honor, everyone sees the pictures and the interviews and David Letterman and ESPN. And, you know, I got to go to the Super Bowl as a recipient and all of these amazing things. And it is incredible. And, you know, I'm a fun, loving life, tackling it full speed ahead. Love football, sports. Like, of course, I am so enjoying these amazing opportunities. But to really think about the medal, you know, the medal represents my story, my injury and my recovery, yes. But then it also represents those long, hard nights in the darkness of my hospital room that my parents sat through and my brother sat through. You know, then it represents my fellow Marines that were there on the ground with me, that got my blood on their hands, keeping me alive and doing everything in their power to get me back home to my family. I'm thankful to be a Marine, and I'm thankful to be an American.
Kyle Carpenter, Medal of Honor recipient, Lance Corporal, United States Marine Corps, author of You Are Worth It, Building a Life Worth Fighting For. We turn from one Marine to another, and now President and Chief Executive Officer of the Marine Toys for Tots Foundation. We want to welcome to Veterans Radio today Lieutenant General Pete Osmond of the United States Marine Corps, retired. He is President and Chief Executive Officer for the Marine Toys for Tots Foundation. General Osmond, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Jim, it's great to be with you and fellow veterans, and appreciate this opportunity to chat with you a little bit about the Marine Toys for Tots program.
Well, it's an important program. It's been around for a long time, but let's start with you just giving us what is today's modern Marine Toys for Tots program all about?
Well, you know, it is probably one of the simplest missions that the Marine Corps has. It's simple through the gift of a new toy or a new book, help bring the joy of Christmas and send a message of hope to America's less fortunate children. You know, it sounds great, great mission. A lot of work goes on behind the scenes in order to make that work, and I'm sure you realize that.
Like every mission, it's all about the execution, isn't it, General?
It sure is. And, you know, our Marines work very, very hard each year and been doing it now for 72 years to execute that mission. But they'd be the first ones to say, could not do it without the great support that we get from our volunteers. Jim, we literally have tens of thousands of civilian volunteers in our communities that will donate tremendous amounts of time in order to help this program work. This is the collection of toys, going to the warehouses, helping sort the toys out, and then helping with the delivery. So these volunteers are really key. And then I can tell you that the Marines, as well as the volunteers, would say, wow, this is great, but couldn't do it without the generosity of the American public. And, Jim, I think we know that Americans are very, very generous. When they see someone in need, they want to help. And believe me, they've been doing that with Marine Toys for Tots for the last 72 years.
And we're talking to the President and Chief Executive Officer of the Marine Toys for Tots Foundation. General Osmond, can you talk to us a little bit about how one gets involved? We're in December of 2019. How do I get involved? I want to help out in some way. Talk to me about ways that I can get involved.
Well, Jim, the best way people can get involved is that when they're out doing their Christmas shopping, pick up an extra toy or two, a couple of books, and then drop them in one of our collection barrels. If you're not going to be shopping or it's not convenient to do that, go to our website, www.toysfortots.org. You'll see a donate button, and there are a variety of ways that people can make donations. You know, make that donation. I guarantee you, whatever you donate will go to the purchase of toys. We have a very enviable program to support ratio, 97-3, which means 97 cents out of every dollar collected goes for the purchase of toys and books for less fortunate children. The 3% overhead merely goes to help fundraising costs, and not one dime donated ever goes to pay anybody's salary. So when your listeners make that donation, they can rest assured that that donation is going to purchase toys.
And
the other way they can help is by volunteering their support. I can guarantee you that the warehouses where we are sorting toys can always use an extra set of hands. So become one of those tens of thousands of volunteers. Contact your local coordinator and say, hey, I got some time this week. Can I come by and help in your warehouse? And I guarantee they would appreciate that support. So lots of ways that your listeners can help the program.
And we're talking nationwide here on this program. Give us some sense of the, you know, can I find a way to participate in every state in these United States?
Well, you know, that's a great question, and people could. If you go to our website, you know, you can make a donation that can be pinpointed to a particular Toys for Tots campaign in a certain county in a certain state. Or you can just make a general donation. In that case, you know, we kind of spread that donation across the country to support campaigns that need additional support. So, you know, both of those ways will guarantee that the donor either can specify a particular place they want their donation to go, or they can literally spread it across the nation. Or if you want to highlight, say, four or five individual campaigns you want to support, you can do that as well. So it really does give the donor a lot of flexibility in how they want their donation to be used.
Well, again, let's restate what the website is, General, for those who want to help out, and maybe that's the most convenient way for them to do it. Could you give us the website again?
Yeah, the website, very simply, is www.toysfortots.org. And not only can you make a donation there, but there's lots of interesting information about the Marine Toys for Tots program, its background history, how it operates, so that the donor has a very, very complete, very full idea of exactly what the program does, how it operates, and can see the goodness that comes out of it.
We hope you enjoyed both of these interviews here on Veterans Radio today. I think the Kyle Carpenter Medal of Honor recipient, an amazing young man, and I think you probably feel the same after hearing him. And I think it was good that we heard about the Marine Toys for Tots program at this time of year, something that all of us should be able to get behind, and maybe we can drop in a toy or hit the website and drop them a dime. That would be an extremely good thing to do at this holiday time of the year. So we hope you enjoyed both of those interviews with Lance Corporal Kyle Carpenter and Lieutenant General Pete Osmond. You probably can't get any farther away in rank pretty much than that, but both special people doing special work for the country. Well, we'd like to encourage you to go to veteransradio.net. Keep in touch with us there. Certainly look at our Facebook site. You might want to hit the new swag store we have up on veteransradio.net. Provide us with some financial support at this time of year, or just buy some swag and wear the ball caps or the T-shirts or the jerseys to promote Veterans Radio when you're out in the community. We're always thrilled to be bringing you this show on WHAM 1600 AM every Saturday, and next week Dale will be back with another great show. And as we slide into the holiday season, all of us at Veterans Radio, from Dale and Bob and Tammy and Mike and myself and the General, Brian, Katie, everybody who's a regular contributor here, Derek in the booth, we all want to thank you for listening and having a great holiday season. And until next time, you are dismissed.